Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Brad Gregory, Dorothy G. Griffin Associate Professor in Early Modern European History at the University of Notre Dame, and author of Salvation at Stake, Christian Martyrdom in Early Modern Europe. Dr. Gregory's appearance was sponsored by the Creighton University Center for Catholic Thought. He'll speak on the topic Theology, the Reformation Era, and the Secularization of Knowledge. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, March 16, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is John O'Keefe, the director of the Center for Catholic Thought at Creighton University.
Before joining the faculty of Notre Dame in 2003, Professor Gregory taught in the history department at Stanford University. And prior to that, he was a junior fellow in the Harvard Society of Fellows and earned his PhD in history from Princeton University in 1996. Professor Gregory was the recipient of two teaching awards at Stanford and one at Notre Dame. In 2005, he was named the winner of the first annual Heat Prize in the Humanities from the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture, a $50,000 award given to the outstanding mid-career humanities scholar in the United States. Please join me in welcoming Professor Gregory as he speaks to us on the topic, Theology, the Reformation Era, and the Secularization of Knowledge.
Thanks very much, John, for the gracious introduction and for the invitation. I'm going to be discussing some ideas from my forthcoming book from Harvard University Press. It's entitled The Unintended Reformation: How a Religious Revolution Secularized Society. The book is about the Reformation era and the multiple ways in which its unresolved religious disagreements continue to influence human life in Europe and North America today, whether through the many unintended changes that they set in motion or through late medieval trends that they dramatically transformed. Part of my book's argument is that these long-term abiding influences tend to be overlooked because of how historians divide up the past, almost always by period, country or region, and type of history, and because of how almost everyone, including historians, tend to think about long-term historical change in strongly supersessionist terms. Medieval realities are regarded as having given way to early modern realities that in turn gave way to modern realities, leading to where we are, a one-way succession of stages that have left Westerners since the early 19th century, in Peter Fritsch's phrase, feeling stranded in the present. Peter Laslett's pre-modern World We Have Lost is assumed to have been left behind with the dramatic transformations wrought by the intellectual, political, social, and technological revolutions of modernity. A corollary of these assumptions and this picture of historical change is the idea that we can account for our world today by relegating its analysis to historians of the modern era and to social scientists. We can understand contemporary Western institutions, ideas, priorities, and practices by concentrating on human life this side of the scientific revolution, the Enlightenment, the American and French revolutions, and the Industrial Revolution. I think this supposition is mistaken, and I argue in my book against the prevailing picture of a strong supersession of ideas, institutions, or eras between the late Middle Ages and the present. Mere temporal succession has too often been conflated with historical explanation. Many of the phenomena I address in my book, such as contemporary consumerism, the modern state's monopoly on public political power, or conceptions of individual rights, might seem to have little to do with each other and to be far removed from the Reformation or from religion per se. But among the book's main arguments are, first, that they tend to be seen as things distant from religion, precisely because religion, as a result of the intractable Christian disagreements of the Reformation era, was incrementally disembedded from the rest of life and theorized as something separable from it. And second, that all domains of human life were unavoidably affected by the disputes and disruptions of the Reformation era because late medieval Christianity was, in all of its diversity, an institutionalized worldview, not a discrete part of life separate from economic, political, social, or cultural realities. It was meant to inform everything, not to be a mere part within the whole. As part of this institutionalized worldview, the church's truth claims about reality were no more separable from the pursuit or transmission of knowledge at the outset of the 16th century than they had been in medieval monasteries since the 6th century or universities since the 13th. In sharp contrast, the pursuit and transmission of knowledge today in research universities assumes that knowledge is and must be secular, in principle separable and separate from any substantive religious claims. It's this aspect of my book, namely the secularization of knowledge, about which I'll be speaking this evening. In a word, how are we to account for the change from Christian theology, regarded as the most important of the faculties and the queen of the sciences in medieval universities, to our present situation, in which not only theology is a discipline, but any and all religious truth claims are excluded from consideration on their own terms in research universities. The outstanding studies of the secularization of American universities in the later 19th century and early 20th century by George Marsden, Julie Rubin, Christian Smith, and other scholars are relevant to this question, but I will suggest tonight that they belong to a late chapter in a much longer story. I recognize, of course, that there are contemporary Catholic institutions, Creighton and Notre Dame among them, as well as some substantively Protestant institutions such as Baylor, that are research universities and or have professional schools, and which thus seek to transmit what is known to undergraduates and to create new knowledge across multiple disciplines. But they do not, at least for the time being or the foreseeable future, I would suggest, set the trends or have much influence in the contemporary world of higher education. Moreover, the secular assumptions that govern knowledge-making profoundly affect research universities with religious identities, including the ways in which scientists and scholars in them do their work. This includes theologians, who are usually devoted not to the integrative endeavor to understand God in relationship to all things, and substantive religious truth claims in relationship to the findings of all other disciplines, but are instead intent on their respective research specializations within theology in ways analogous to scholars and scientists in other disciplines. The usual answer to the question I've posed, how did higher education come to be ideologically secular, is that it's une question mal posée, right? A badly put question. Religious truth claims were not ideologically excluded, so the story goes, but rather simply recognized for what they were, cultural constructions and subjective opinions based on pre-modern mythic conceptions of reality that were rendered untenable by the advances of modern knowledge itself. Scientific discovery and humanistic inquiry were the two pinchers of the modern intellectual scissors that excised theology from knowledge-making. With respect to science, once the empirical investigation and mathematization of natural regularities reached an impressive first culmination with Newton at the end of the 17th century, the universe is a vast mechanism of efficient causes left no room for God's putative actions in history, including alleged miracles such as those reported in the Gospels. The 17th century revolution in physics was followed by the 19th century Darwinian revolution in biology, which undercut the biblical idea of deliberate design and loving creation by God. It made of Homo sapiens just another species that happened randomly to evolve by the blind processes of natural selection, for which Watson and Crick later supplied the mechanism in their research on DNA. Since then, the extraordinary advances in neo-Darwinian evolutionary biology have further confirmed the disenchantment of the world asserted by Max Weber and left us, in the words of the philosopher John Searle, with, like it or not, simply the worldview we have, one without God and without any place for religious truth claims such as those characteristic of the traditional Christianity that modern science superseded. Therefore, knowledge, its pursuit and its transmission, as opposed to subjective belief, naive wishful thinking, uninformed opinion, or superstitious ignorance, are and must be secular. The second pincher in the scissor-like and supposedly non-ideological elimination of theology from any place in knowledge-making, so the story continues, came from the side of humanistic scholarship. The advent of historicism and critical philology among Renaissance humanists such as Valla, Poliziano, and Erasmus, radicalized by biblical critics such as Spinoza and Richard Simon in the late 17th century, came in the hands of more unflinching critics in the 18th and 19th centuries to show, for starters, the extraordinary contingency of the formation and textual transmission of the Old and New Testaments, which led to what Hans Fry called the eclipse of biblical narrative and what Michael Legaspi has recently termed the death of Scripture. Relatedly, ancient peoples lived lives utterly different from latter-day Westerners, based on radically different worldviews. And the first task of any scholar seeking to understand them was, and remains, to grasp this first principle of historicism, the unbridgeable difference between us and them. In 1777, Lessing pronounced himself unable to cross the broad and ugly ditch between historical claims on the one hand and moral and metaphysical claims on the other, making of modern historicism no less a barrier to the foundational claims of Christianity than is disenchantment allegedly born of modern science. For Christianity's fundamental claim is that the one creator God of love acted decisively in history by becoming incarnate in Jesus of Nazareth, whose life and teachings are the definitive expression of God's will, not only for his chosen people, the Jews, but for all human beings, and who after his crucifixion was raised by God from the dead. This is a claim which, whatever else it does, certainly combines historical, physical, metaphysical, and moral claims. Anyone, then, who wants a place in the modern research university must follow Lessing, and F.H. Bradley, Ernst Troeltsch, Rudolf Bultmann, and others, and separate knowledge-making from faith, acknowledging that historicism precludes the consideration of religious truth claims derived from ancient cultures as if they might actually be true. So, too, historical research, beginning especially in the 17th and 18th centuries, disclosed a vast array of other ancient peoples with their respective beliefs in gods and supernatural powers, among whom the Israelites and later the first Christians were just two, just as early modern contact with non-Christian peoples and cultures around the world confirmed the same thing about the present. Knowledge was thus further secularized by the relativizing recognition that Christianity's exclusivist truth claims were merely one set among very many rivals. Now, among the arguments I make in my book is that both of these widely believed accounts are wrong. Not because the findings of the natural sciences per se are somehow untrustworthy or suspect, nor because historicism is not a necessary safeguard against anachronism, nor again because there are not, in fact, many religions and ideologies in addition to Christianity, but rather because of the inferences that have been typically drawn from them. My point is that there is no intrinsic or necessary connection between the findings of the natural sciences, historicism or pluralism, and the conclusions that are usually drawn from them, and which have become institutionalized in the secularization of knowledge. The findings of the natural sciences do not preclude the possibility that a transcendent creator God is real and acts in history, including actions outside the course of natural regularities. Such a conviction is based rather on the alchemy, whereby the perfectly legitimate methodological precept of naturalism in the sciences is transmuted into a metaphysical dogma about reality. As if, because the sciences do not discover empirical evidence in space and time, of what is definitionally neither spatial nor temporal, therefore God is a fiction. So too, neither the complexity of the biblical accounts about Jesus preclude, as the accounts themselves clearly intend, that the gist of what they claim actually happened, nor does the fact that extraordinary things are alleged to have happened long ago among peoples with different worldviews preclude that they might actually have occurred. Finally, it does not follow from the fact of pluralism that relativism is true. If God accomplished in Jesus what Christians claim he accomplished, this cannot be undone by pointing to the obvious fact that many people believe different things, even if there is no way to demonstrate to everyone's satisfaction that Christian truth claims are what they purport to be. Skepticism is always possible, but it does not follow logically or necessarily from pluralism, and it brings with it problems of its own. The historical processes through which knowledge was eventually secularized were more convoluted and more paradoxical than the dominant narrative would have us believe. For it was neither science nor critical humanistic scholarship per se, but rather the Protestant Reformation, by introducing an unintended and unprecedentedly enduring doctrinal pluralism within Western Christianity, that laid the foundations for the eventual secularization of knowledge. But only in the long term, and only after a long interlude in which theology became more rather than less important in the confessional universities, academies, and seminaries of early modern Europe. Besides the introduction and institutionalization of doctrinal pluralism, it was ironically and precisely the political protection of theology that insulated it from knowledge-making from the 16th through the 18th centuries in the large majority of universities, and thus set theologians up for a fall from which they have never recovered institutionally. Regardless of the intellectual viability today of some theologies in relationship to all the findings, and indeed, I would argue, all the possible findings of the natural sciences, the eventual secularization of knowledge happened as a long-term, unintended result of the Reformation's doctrinal contestation and the privileging of theology in the confessionally divided higher educational institutions of early modern Europe. Circa 1510, knowledge in Latin Christendom was not secular, but rather included Christian truth claims about God's actions in history, most importantly in the incarnation, life, teachings, death, and resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth. Qualitatively different kinds of knowledge of natural regularities, the historical past, ancient texts, and the firsthand experience of Christian life were interrelated within the diverse, vibrant, and sometimes contentious intellectual culture of Western Christendom. Think of the clashes between scholastic theologians and humanists, for example, in northern universities such as Paris, Louvain, and Cologne in the 15-teens. And neither social practices nor morality nor the uses to which knowledge were put were separated from knowledge as such. The seed for the eventual secularization of knowledge was planted by enduring doctrinal disagreement and unintended Western Christian pluralism. Nor was this simply a matter of Protestantism versus Roman Catholicism, as though Protestantism designated something with discernibly coherent doctrines, practices, and institutions analogous to Catholicism, rather than being an umbrella designation of an open-ended range of competing anti-Roman reformers, groups, and views. Reformation historians have tended to separate the magisterial Reformation from the radical Reformation, just as they have tended tacitly to conflate the interpretation of the Bible with the exercise of political power in the 16th and 17th centuries. This has had two unfortunate and distorting consequences. First, it has tended to conceal what, in fact, the shared commitment to the principle of sola scriptura, supplemented by claims about the authenticating testimony of the Holy Spirit, actually produced. And second, it has led many scholars to identify the claims of the only two anti-Roman traditions that secured lasting political support, namely the Lutheran and the Reformed, with doctrinally normative Protestantism, as though these things were intrinsically related. But the Reformation as a whole produced not even a rough consensus about what God's word meant and implied. And a wide range of radical Protestants made clear that sola scriptura led neither obviously nor necessarily to sola fide or sola gratia, as Lutherans and Reformed Protestants asserted. Despite assertions of biblical perspicuity, rival anti-Roman Christians demonstrated how separable was the reading of Scripture as such from any given set of Christian doctrines or related practices. With respect to the transmission of knowledge in universities, however, the implications of this Protestant heterogeneity would long remain muted, because so few Reformation-era forms of Protestantism won political backing from political authorities. To put it bluntly, there were no Swiss Brethren, Hutterite, Mennonite, Spiritualist, Familist, Socinian, or Quaker universities in the Reformation era. In fact, until the establishment of the Dissenter Academies in Restoration England, no European institutions of higher education were affiliated with radical Protestants. On the doctrinal issues about which Reformation-era Christians disagreed, it was logically impossible for all of them actually to have been correct, and therefore impossible for them all to have had the knowledge of God's teachings that they claimed to have. Theological controversialists of every stripe understood this, well aware of the principle of non-contradiction. Hence, they engaged in ongoing doctrinal controversy in literally tens of thousands of publications from the 1520s through the 17th century and beyond, to no avail. Eventually, by the late 19th century, as we shall see, persistent doctrinal disagreements would foster the exclusion of all substantive religious truth claims from research universities. For especially in contexts of politically protected individual religious freedom in the modern era that produced so many conflicting doctrinal claims, how could one arbitrate among them? Doctrinal contestation and disagreement continued to mark the 1880s no less than they had the 1580s. In combination with unresolved doctrinal disagreement, another deeply ironic factor that laid the foundation for the eventual secularization of knowledge derived from early modern states' control of churches. This was the very privileging of theology in the confessionalized universities of the Reformation era among Roman Catholics, Lutherans, and Reformed Protestants, and I include the Church of England for analytical purposes among Reformed Protestantism. In contrast to the treatment of the many marginalized radical Protestant groups, only Catholic and magisterial Protestant churches were protected and overseen by secular authorities in their respective confessional regimes. For good reason. The Peasants' War of 1525 showed dramatically what could happen when the gospel was let loose among the common man. And the immediate origins of the Reformation itself, in a seemingly innocuous proposal for academic theologians in a provincial university to dispute 95 propositions about the misunderstanding of indulgences, demonstrated that universities could be explosive places. Higher education was dangerous because some ideas could inspire the subversion of political order, God's truth, or both, on which the salvation of subjects and God's providential favor depended. Yet universities and similar institutions that proliferated in the 16th century were indispensable to rulers. There was no institutional alternative for training the lawyers, jurists, secretaries, diplomats, physicians, pastors, and educators needed to staff the growing governmental bureaucracies and dutifully to maintain good order. So the only way forward was clear. Just as biblical interpretation had to be corralled and churches had to be controlled, universities, seminaries, and colleges had to be regulated. Higher education had to be enlisted to serve God's truth. Just as sovereigns relied on ecclesiastical authorities as partners in confessionalization, so they relied on theologians to articulate Christian truth and to establish parameters for the pursuit of knowledge in other university faculties. Accordingly, in concert with the desires of secular authorities, theology remained in the 16th century the preeminent and privileged subject in universities no less than it had been before the Reformation. Rulers concerned with doctrine, linked to the social virtue of obedience in an era of religious division, dictated that universities had to be socially, morally, and intellectually stabilizing and conservative institutions. Accordingly, the curricula in the faculties of nearly all Reformation-era universities were circumscribed by confessional criteria and directed principally toward teaching rather than research. Although universities were far from intellectually moribund, the resources of various sorts of knowledge, humanistic, scholastic, and scientific, were employed in the service of doctrinal truth claims and consistent with confessionalization, whether Catholic, Lutheran, or Reformed. By privileging theology in universities, protecting orthodoxy from scholarly challenges, and policing intellectual inquiry, authorities curtailed the interactions between a regime's religious truth claims and other domains of human knowledge. The large majority of early modern universities thus fostered complacency among those who taught in their theology and arts faculties by prohibiting the pursuit of doctrinally sensitive sorts of inquiry, whether continuing philological and historical questions about the relationship between extant biblical manuscripts and the formation of the canonical text, or asking in sustained ways how Christian doctrines were related to new discoveries about the natural world. So, too, time spent on doctrinal controversy was time not spent on keeping up with new knowledge or seeking to understand God in relation to all things. All human decisions have their opportunity costs. Meanwhile, intellectual inquiry did not stand still in the early modern period. Far from it. But it increasingly migrated outside universities. And this, too, in significant ways, at the behest of the same rulers who maintained oversight of their confessional universities. On the demand side of knowledge-making in the Reformation era, rulers provided its most important sites outside universities, just as they relied on universities to transmit knowledge and to train professionals in ways that would maintain order within their confessionalizing regimes. This was no contradiction. It simply meant that universities did not satisfy all the ambitions of early modern rulers. So the rulers fashioned a knowledge-making symbiosis between intellectually inquisitive and socially striving men who were drawn to the rewards of patronage and rulers who gained new knowledge from them to serve their desires in running their lives in their confessional states. It was hardly the late 20th century's military-industrial complex, but we can see here a distant ancestor of the modern relationship between knowledge-making and state power. In early modern Europe, the most important sites for this symbiosis were rulers' courts and, especially from the second half of the 17th century, scientific academies. The courts of sovereigns and nobles had existed throughout the Middle Ages, but the 16th century brought new responsibilities and new opportunities. The religious divisions opened by the Reformation entailed new necessities of military defense and new prospects for war. The stakes were anything but academic. Matters as seemingly ethereal as the mathematization of motion and Neo-Stoic philosophy, for example, could influence the prosperity of states through their applications in better ballistics and better disciplined armies. The discovery of the New World heralded a constantly increasing flow of new knowledge to early modern courts about hitherto unknown peoples, fauna, and flora from hitherto unknown continents. Rulers' money fueled commercial and missionary expeditions that brought back the new data and the physical specimens, and the prospects of exploitable mineral resources, medicinally valuable plants, and slave labor. With the training of useful professionals and the conservative transmission of knowledge being met by confessionalized universities, Reformation-era rulers made their respective courts the site for the production of new knowledge that could serve differently their desires for prestige, power, and obedience to God. Why could the stabilizing function of higher education safeguarded by orthodoxy not coexist with the creation of new knowledge loosened from curricular constraints and authoritative texts? For the latter, rulers could assemble and monitor the intellectual talent, the libraries, botanical gardens, observatories, natural historical collections, and laboratory facilities right in their own palace complexes. And they did. Small wonder, then, as Bruce Moran has put it, technical expertise, novel procedures, and the critique of ancient traditions stand out prominently within court environments in contrast with universities as means appropriate for acquiring knowledge of nature. Small wonder, too, that early modern courts figured importantly in the careers of numerous figures central to the emergent new science, including Galileo, for example, who left a position teaching mathematics at the University of Padua for a plum post as the Medici's court philosopher and mathematician in Florence in 1610, and the astronomers Tycho Brahe and Johannes Kepler, who worked at Rudolf II's dazzling court in Prague. Perhaps more telling is the pantheon of major contributors to the new science who never taught as university professors. Not only Brahe and Kepler, but also Copernicus, Descartes, Bacon, Mersenne, Hobbes, Pascal, Boyle, Leibniz, Christian Huygens, and Leeuwenhoek. Indeed, Descartes, Pascal, Boyle, and Leeuwenhoek never formally attended a university. The new mechanistic model of nature arose almost entirely outside of universities. Gassendi was the only first-generation advocate who held a university professorship at Aix-en-Provence before Cartesianism spread. Aristotelian natural philosophy in universities did not generate new knowledge that rulers could use. In contrast to the hands-on, descriptive, experimental methods and information gathering at their courts. Now, the longer that rulers championed rival doctrines in their universities and shielded theologians, the less prepared would the latter eventually be to answer questions about how their respective Christian truth claims might fit together with the ever-growing mass of new knowledge being made elsewhere. By the mid-17th century, things looked inauspicious for the epistemological status of theology and Christian experiential knowledge. More than a century of ongoing controversies among university-trained protagonists had brought doctrinal disagreements no closer to resolution than they had been in the 1520s. On the contrary, unfettered anew during the English Revolution, Protestantism demonstrated its open-endedness and the astonishing range of adjunct claims about the character of Christian experiential knowledge among, say, the Reformed Protestant framers of the Westminster Confession of Faith, the General Baptist leader Henry Denne, the Digger Gerard Winstanley, and the Quaker James Naylor. As their respective protagonists well knew, the principle of non-contradiction meant that not all of the competing claims could be correct. Therefore, not all of them could belong to knowledge. Nor was it apparent how such disagreements could be resolved, so long as each protagonist functioned as a de facto hermeneutic authority. Unsurprisingly, then, enduring Christian pluralism prompted some observers to draw skeptical conclusions about religion per se, which meshed with the robust revival of Pyrrhonian skepticism in the late 16th and early 17th centuries. Nor is it surprising that thinkers such as Thomas Hobbes, John Wilkins, and John Locke began in diverse ways to distinguish between what was merely believed as a matter of faith and opinion from what could be known on the basis of observation and reason. This distinction, of course, has remained influential right up to the present. Moreover, by the mid-17th century, it was apparent that in contrast to the character of endlessly contested Christian doctrinal claims, the knowledge gained through observations in botanical gardens, dissections in anatomy theaters, and experiments in alchemical laboratories was different. The latter sort of knowledge did not depend on one's interpretation of Paul's letter to the Romans or theology of the Lord's Supper. It looked to be the same in Protestant Scotland as in Catholic Italy. It was universal and it was useful. It could be concretely applied to serve the desires of rulers and subjects alike, able, in Francis Bacon's words, to produce worthy effects and to endow the life of man with infinite new commodities. And there were prospects for resolving disagreements about it through shared empirical attention to the matters at hand, regardless of one's religious views. By the end of the Thirty Years' War and the English Revolution, the religio-political conflicts of the Reformation era had proven hugely expensive, massively destructive, and conspicuously inconclusive. What had they accomplished? God's providence had frustrated ruler after ruler, all of whom had failed to achieve their principal objectives regardless of conviction or devotion. The concrete devastation and disruption understandably dampened enthusiasm for further rounds of military engagement, motivated to whatever extent by religious commitments. It unsurprisingly fostered interest in types of knowledge that would be less troublesome, ones geared toward goals about which antagonistic Christians were more likely to concur, such as the pleasures and comforts that accompanied the acquisition of more and better possessions in what Jan de Vries has analyzed as the Industrious Revolution. Although throughout the 18th century, theology would remain firmly ensconced in most universities, which rulers still needed, of course, for the training of clergy and other officials to serve their confessional states, its privileged position was no longer obvious. In the mid-17th century, what had theologians done for rulers lately? Their continuing shelter rendered most theologians ever less likely to be able to cope in intellectual terms with the knowledge-making that proceeded ever more outside universities. The most important new institutions for knowledge-making in the later 17th century, the Royal Society of London, chartered in 1662, and the Académie Royale des Sciences of Paris, 1666, the first of a wave of such institutions that were established over the next century in many European cities, presupposed a self-conscious distinction between theology and scientific knowledge. In expounding orthodoxy, safeguarding souls, battling opponents, and essentially abandoning theology's medieval aspiration to integrate any and all truth about God and creation, Lutheran, Reformed, and Catholic theologians had been living in an ever more vulnerable refuge. In their respective ways, the theological protagonists of long-insulated confessional orthodoxies lacked the ability to see how their respective doctrinal claims might fit with the profusion of new knowledge. Moreover, the universities that fared best in accommodating new knowledge were those with the fewest confessional strictures: Leiden in the 17th century, Edinburgh, Glasgow, Halle, and Göttingen in the 18th. Their predecessors, having been protected since the early 16th century, long shielded in confessional universities from the wider world of knowledge-making, few 18th-century theologians were in a position to respond to rationalist criticisms of their respective assertions or of revealed religion in general. They lacked the intellectual wherewithal to see how, for example, their doctrinal truth claims might cohere with Newtonian physics or the existence of peoples who long antedated the creation accounts in Genesis. Nor were they in a position to distinguish the indisputable empirical gains of the new knowledge from the tendentious metaphysical, moral, and historical beliefs with which enlightened protagonists almost always combined and advanced them under the ideologically conflationary banner of reason. Later in the century, Johann Georg Hamann's critique would call out Kant's critique of pure reason on just this score. But such insight among contemporaries in the 18th century was rare, just as Pascal had been rare among leading intellectuals in repudiating the rationalist God of the philosophers in the mid-17th century. Still less were most theologians intellectually attuned to recognize the assumptions embedded in domestication of Christian truth claims by Protestant scholars, such as those on the faculty at Göttingen, who were fashioning new alternatives. One had to know a great deal to engage leading intellectuals on their turf, and few 18th-century theologians knew enough, despite exceptions such as New England's Jonathan Edwards, for example, or the polymathic historian and Italian priest Ludovico Antonio Muratori, or the Jesuit scientist Roger Joseph Boscovich. Moreover, the new Protestant truth claims at Göttingen were being used in tandem with new commitments and for new purposes, most consequentially those that served the Hanoverian state. When biblical scholars such as Johann Salomo Semler, Johann David Michaelis, and Johann Gottfried Eichhorn published provocative ideas about the complex formation and character of the biblical text as the cultural product of a deep and dead past, very few theologians had the learning necessary to distinguish philological achievement from philosophical assumption. Once Newtonianism had triumphed, even in most continental universities by the 1750s, theologians were more vulnerable than ever. The leading figures of the Enlightenment, Newtonians to a man, were undiscriminating despisers of Aristotle and Scholasticism. Yet confessional theologians could not articulate in intellectually persuasive ways why it was so problematic to try to explain human morality, politics, and social life on the basis of empirical observation and efficient causality alone. They could not see clearly, as contemporary thinkers today, such as Peter Winch and Alistair MacIntyre have, that once intentionality and linguistically mediated meanings are extruded from human actions, they cease to be intelligible as human actions at all, and thus cannot in principle be understood on the model of the natural sciences. Not that the anti-Aristotelian pioneers in the 18th century would have been persuaded, even if such critiques had been forthcoming and they had attended to them. As I argue elsewhere in my book, theorists such as David Hume and Adam Smith were uncritically innocent of the difference between historically constructed desires and putatively universal human nature, and thus thought that they were advancing enlightened reason when in fact they were legitimating acquisitive ideologies on the basis of introspection and the observation of Northwestern Europeans shaped by the Industrious Revolution. Confessional theologians, however, were in no position to make substantive critiques, their place in universities having long afforded them safe harbor from the turbulent waters of early modern knowledge-making, and hence having kept them aloof from inquiring seriously about how so much new knowledge might fit together with their respective doctrinal truth claims. Instead, they were mocked by Voltaire, jeered by the encyclopédistes, and ridiculed by almost everyone who was anyone in the enlightened world of European learning. Nothing symbolizes the rejection of Christian theology better than the progressive exclusion of the Jesuits, the religious order that epitomized Catholic erudition and teaching for more than two centuries from Europe's Catholic countries, beginning with Pombal's Portugal in 1759 and concluding with Pope Clement XIV's suppression of the order in 1773. The rejection of theology was also symbolized in the anti-Catholic destruction wrought by the French Revolution itself, and in the suppression of universities and the seizure of monasteries by political leaders in France and elsewhere in Catholic Europe. The French Revolution and the Napoleonic era were devastating for European higher education. Where there had been 143 universities in 1789, there were only 83 in 1815. These years comprise a major caesura in the relationship between universities and religious truth claims, theology, knowledge-making, the state, and individual human desires, even though all of the major elements in the subsequent secularization of knowledge were already present before the beginning of the 19th century. To be sure, they unfolded in a wide range of highly contingent ways in the particular institutions of different European countries as well as in North America. With the exception of Catholic universities, which followed suit later, by the early 20th century, universities both in Europe and North America had arrived in more or less the same place, with religious truth claims excluded in principle from the pursuit and transmission of knowledge in the secularized academy. Despite its indebtedness to Halle, Göttingen, and the philosophical idealists at Jena in the 1790s, the founding of the University of Berlin in 1809-10 is widely regarded as inaugurating the era of the modern research university. It brought knowledge-making unequivocally back into the university setting. Berlin became the most influential model for the reform of existing and the establishment of new universities in Germany, and German research universities, in turn, adapted in diverse ways, became, from the second half of the 19th century, the most important model for universities in other countries in Europe, North America, and eventually around the world. But Berlin in the 18-teens was as different from what research universities a century later would become as it was from the confessional universities of early modern Europe. The new romantic university at Berlin in its early years intensified certain institutional structures and ideological emphases that would endure and whose transformation, in combination with other historical realities, would produce the secularization of knowledge that is largely taken for granted today. The most consequential among these structures and emphases were the sequestration of theology, a commitment to research, an emphasis on the self, and a reliance on the state. Berlin differed most obviously from confessional universities in the definitive dethroning of theology from its place of privilege. Extending a pattern pioneered by Leiden and Göttingen, theology retained its own faculty, but had no influence on other academic subjects in the philosophy faculty, the ancestor of modern university schools of arts and sciences. This quarantining of theology institutionalized Kant's argument in his Conflict of the Faculties, that philosophy, as the expression of autonomous reason and human freedom, should be liberated from the confining constraints of theology. In the long term, this move contributed importantly to the secularization of knowledge by allowing other disciplines to ignore religious questions entirely as they conducted their respective inquiries. Emancipated from dogmatic shackles, the aim of the Romantic Research University was not simply knowledge for its own sake, nor the pursuit of discoveries that would contribute to the sum of all knowledge, nor the Baconian pursuit of useful scientific knowledge, but rather Wissenschaft oriented to Bildung, the full self-development of the individual student's interests, capacities, and personality as the subjective realization of his unfettered freedom and autonomy. Research in the Romantic University meant not the pursuit of specialized knowledge within a discipline, but rather concerned the inculcation of unified principles of scientific inquiry that retained a commitment to the unity of knowledge in a manner formally analogous to the same in medieval Christianity. But in fact, this enterprise resembled medieval Christian theology as little as the romantic cult of the self-directing individual concerned habituation and Christian virtues within a shared way of life. In the Romantic Research University, the unity of knowledge did not mean theology as the relationship of God to all things. It meant rather the subjective vision of the autonomous individual within the sublime whole of the cosmos, conceived as Naturphilosophie in the manner of Schelling, with which men such as Wilhelm von Humboldt and his brother, the naturalist explorer Alexander, had replaced creation understood in traditional Christian terms. Like Romanticism as a worldview, the Romantic Research University disappeared from Germany during the 19th century, but important aspects of it were adopted in the United States, where they were hybridized with enthusiasm for Emersonian individualism and transcendentalism. By the end of the 19th century, the principal purpose of research had changed dramatically and had taken root in the transplantation and adaptation of universities inspired by the German model in countries on both sides of the North Atlantic. No longer focused on the self-realization of the individual student, the aim of research had become the increase of new knowledge per se as the defining, prestige-garnering activity of professionalizing scientists and scholars. Beginning in the 1870s, that newfangled American adaptation of the German system, the graduate school, expressly dedicated to the pursuit of specialized knowledge, was either grafted onto the undergraduate colleges, as in the case of existing institutions such as Harvard under Charles Eliot, or was made the centerpiece of new institutions such as Johns Hopkins under Daniel Coit Gilman. Greater specialization was reflected in the formation of increasingly distinct academic disciplines, including many familiar now in the tripartite division of the natural sciences, social sciences, and humanities. After Justus von Liebig demonstrated the pedagogical utility and the real-life applicability of laboratory chemistry in a university setting at Gießen in 1824, universities increasingly emphasized the natural sciences and medicine. Within a few decades, these disciplines overshadowed the philology and philosophy that had animated the Romantic Research University. By the end of the 19th century, the cumulative character of new natural scientific knowledge and its demonstrably successful applications had secured the dominance of the natural sciences in research universities that they have held ever since. Engineering and technology applied the scientific discoveries that fostered capitalist production, increased state military power, stimulated agricultural yields, and fed consumer acquisitiveness during the second industrial revolution of the late 19th century. Through observation, measurement, quantification, and experiment, natural scientists sought data that could be used to formulate theories in the quest to discover the laws characteristic of natural regularities, which could be used in turn to make predictions capable of verification. Then their findings could be applied through instrumental rationality in the service of human desires. The sciences worked. In the end, this rendered beside the point all abstruse questions about the epistemological status of their findings. They worked regardless of what their practitioners thought about God, or indeed whether they thought about God at all. The natural sciences demonstrated that methodological naturalism was a fruitful assumption and evidentiary empiricism the necessary method in the attempt to understand natural regularities, whether in Pasteur's microbiology or Helmholtz's physics. Because the natural sciences were so successful, the nascent social sciences wanted to be just like them. Economists with physics envy, right? If social scientists were to make similar progress in their inquiries, they reasoned, they should adopt the same methodological naturalism and empiricism so as to seek to discover the objective universal laws that govern human behavior, social life, political relations, and economic activity. Thus might they realize the Enlightenment aspiration to apply Newtonianism to human life, albeit, they thought, with a rigorous empiricism, the fulfillment of what Auguste Comte called a social physics. For as one of sociology's founding figures, Emile Durkheim, put it, society, quote, is part of nature and nature's highest expression. The social realm is a natural realm that differs from others only in its greater complexity. Indeed, the implications of new social sciences, such as sociology and psychology, were far from purely theoretical, because if their practitioners could discover invariable laws, human behavior could be accurately predicted and closely managed. By the end of the 19th century, the success of the natural sciences had made their epistemology the paradigm for knowledge as such. Thus, knowledge was universal, objective, and not dependent on the divergent personal individual beliefs of its practitioners. This contrasted dramatically with Protestantism as an empirical social reality, as had been the case since the early 1520s. But the intellectual implications of this fact had been minimized in early modern Europe because only Lutheran and Reformed Protestant regimes, including the Church of England, had universities. The confessional character of magisterial Protestant universities had permitted politically privileged theologians within a given regime largely to ignore the fact of Protestant pluralism derived from sola scriptura, and to defer the confrontation with much of the early modern knowledge-making that went on outside universities. By design and from the time of its founding, of course, the United States was never a confessional country. But before the Civil War, the widespread adoption of Scottish common-sense philosophy in divergently Protestant American colleges not only served as a shared intellectual scaffolding analogous to Aristotelianism in the Reformation era, but also functioned in crypto-confessional ways. It veiled the implications of Protestant doctrinal disagreements. Despite the extraordinary proliferation of different Protestant groups and claims during the first half of the 19th century, a masterful book by Nathan Hatch, Protestant professors at American colleges continued to rely on inductive, fact-gathering Baconian science, refracted through Scottish Enlightenment moral philosophy and epistemology, to sustain their commitment to the unity of knowledge. But after 1870 or so, their epistemological mirage was exposed. American Protestant theologians were as little equipped to handle the intellectual challenges of Darwinism, German biblical criticism, and historicism as Aristotelian natural philosophers had been prepared to accommodate Newtonianism in the 18th century. Even more fundamentally, they had no answer when confronted with the principle of non-contradiction concerning their rival truth claims, beyond either redoubled proclamations of the correctness of their respective views, which only underscored the problem, or an attempt to determine, as some sort of lowest common denominator, what it was that all Protestants shared in common, and then to promote it. Those in higher education, public life, and industry who desired the secularization of knowledge seized their opportunity. Through deliberate, self-conscious efforts from the 1870s through the 1920s, they changed, although not all at once, the status quo of higher education in what Christian Smith has called the secular revolution. In the end, knowledge-making and teaching in leading American universities was secularized because the de facto diversity and individualism of Protestant truth claims could not be reconciled with the epistemological demands of science for universality and objectivity. In this sense, knowledge did not merely happen to be secularized because American Protestant theologians lacked the wherewithal to handle new intellectual challenges. It had to be because of the unintended and unwanted consequences of the Reformation itself. Despite centuries of claims about Scripture's perspicuity, there had never been anything remotely resembling a consensus about what the Bible said. The institutionalization of individual religious freedom, pioneered in the United States, revealed what the Reformation as such produced, absent the power of political authorities standing behind hermeneutic authorities. It produced the aggregate of whatever individuals happened to prefer, which fit perfectly with the ideology of American individualism that so struck Tocqueville and other 19th century European visitors to the U.S. But it did not fit at all with knowledge making. Once research on the German model, with the natural sciences as the epistemological standard, became the aspiration for American universities. So knowledge had to be secularized and religious truth claims excluded from universities, just as religious convictions had to be privatized. Indeed, again, Hobbes and Locke regarded as subjective beliefs and opinions, no matter their content or the religious tradition. Those Protestant theologians and skeptical biblical scholars who hitched their wagon to post-Kantian philosophy found its payload progressively lightened until it was unclear how Christianity could consist of anything more than post-Schleiermacherian pious sentiments. If natural scientists study the material world from which miracles had been excluded, history covered the ancient Near East along with the rest of the human past, psychology analyzed human interiority and behavior, and anthropology explained rituals and their functions, what was left for theologians to do? In the past two centuries, the secularization of knowledge has been overwhelmingly a phenomenon born of Protestantism, from the Romantic Research University to the leading American institutions which, after the blows inflicted on German universities from the Great War through Hitler's Reich, have become the world's pace-setting institutions of higher education. The secularization of Catholic higher education followed a different path. The overriding curricular weakness of Catholic theology from the post-French revolutionary ultramontanism to the Second Vatican Council was both institutional and intellectual. Its isolation in seminaries and its narrow focus on philosophical issues at the expense of attempting to understand the Church's teachings in relationship to the exponential increase in new knowledge. The neo-Thomism institutionalized in Catholic higher education, especially after Leo XIII's Aeterni Patris in 1879, downplayed knowledge-making in other disciplines and kept research in them at a distance from the Aristotelian and Thomistic philosophical categories that underpin the theology. This distancing was reinforced by papal encyclicals such as Pascendi Dominici Gregis in 1907 and Humani Generis in 1950, which, as a symptomatic reflection of Catholic theology's long-standing insulation from the wider world of knowledge-making, lumped together many stranded and complex intellectual issues under conflationary labels like modernism. Partly for this reason, with the possible exception of Louvain in Belgium, no Catholic institutions were among the world's leading research universities in the early or mid-20th century. This fact helped to make Catholicism's truth claims seem all the more hollow to non-Catholics, who were more likely to concur with George Bernard Shaw's dictum that ideological restrictions and a lack of academic freedom made the very idea of a Catholic university a contradiction in terms. If Protestantism, enriched by the Scottish or German Enlightenments, could not stand up to historicist scholarship, critical philosophy, and the findings of science, how could intellectually retrograde, papally dominated, superstitious Catholicism possibly hope to? The Neo-Thomist curriculum of American Catholic higher education essentially evaporated within a decade beginning in the 1960s. This was not simply because Catholics were eager to embrace the modern world in the wake of Vatican II's aggiornamento, but because of the papally reinforced gap between what Catholicism purported to be on the one hand and cutting-edge knowledge-making in leading research universities on the other. Beginning in the 1960s, understandably self-critical Catholic universities had a lot of intellectual catching up to do amidst a swirl of dramatic social changes and political turmoil in society at large. But in accepting modernity with scarcely less eagerness than preceding popes had denounced it, their leaders tended uncritically to embrace many tangled, hidden assumptions embedded in the history of the secularized institutions whose structures and practices they adopted. Even when refracted through certain Catholic lenses, these assumptions fostered the secularization of knowledge. If a particular and quite common misreading of Aquinas on faith and reason, for example, was thought to model the institutional relationship between theology and all other disciplines, theology is to faith, revelation, and supernatural grace, as all other disciplines are to knowledge, reason, and the natural world, then one essentially sequestered Catholic truth claims from the rest of knowledge-making, in a manner similar to theology's demotion in the 19th century Romantic Research University, but in a different idiom. Even among Catholic institutions that did not make the inherently relativizing and secularizing move of replacing theology with religious studies departments, theology's integrative potential would be lost if it was simply regarded as one self-contained discipline among others. The same was true of philosophy. If it was thought that the solution to the problem of intellectually staid neo-Thomism as taught through textbooks was simply the imitation of philosophy as it was done in secular universities. So too, with so many tendentious moral and metaphysical assumptions in social scientific and humanistic disciplines interwoven with academic research, much of knowledge-making was bound to conflict with Catholic truth claims. In a rush to make up for lost time and to narrow the embarrassing gap between the level of knowledge-making in Catholic institutions and in leading research universities, university leaders unwittingly invited in an intellectual Trojan horse bearing a load of subversive assumptions. No wonder American Catholic universities have been in a state of perpetual hand-wringing and confusion and endless debates about Catholic identity ever since. Most Catholic institutions rapidly secularized the academic part of their universities in the 1960s and 70s as if it were separable from the other parts, like nature was supposedly separable from grace. And then they wondered why everything else changed too. If my revisionist account is near the mark, and neither the findings of science, nor historicism, nor pluralism per se warrant the conclusions usually drawn from them, despite how deeply ingrained such conclusions are in the received narrative of modern intellectual history and the secularization of knowledge, then the implications and imperatives would seem rather considerable. One implication would be that what is widely regarded as an intellectual inevitability has actually been and remains an ideological imperialism, namely, the conviction that any and all claims of revealed religion per se are incompatible with the findings of the natural sciences and historical research. And one imperative would be that among the most important tasks of Catholic theologians and Catholic intellectuals more broadly is to learn enough and to know enough to criticize the entrenched ideology on the one hand and to show the compatibility between the claims of the Catholic faith and the genuine findings of all other academic disciplines on the other. If Catholicism is what it purports to be, namely, true, then Catholic intellectuals should be engaged in the enterprise of showing how this is so in relationship to the full range of intellectual inquiry in the natural sciences, social sciences, and humanities. Then might they regard themselves as latter-day heirs to the medieval intellectual endeavor that sought to show the relationship of God to all things. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Brad Gregory, Dorothy G. Griffin Associate Professor in Early Modern European History at the University of Notre Dame, and author of Salvation at Stake, Christian Martyrdom in Early Modern Europe. Dr. Gregory's appearance was sponsored by the Creighton University Center for Catholic Thought. He spoke on the topic, Theology, the Reformation Era, and the Secularization of Knowledge. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, March 16, 2011, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.